Good morning. This panel of the court will now hear oral argument in the second case on today's calendar, case number A20-1172, Teresa McNabb versus John Kisielichin. And if counsel for appellant wishes to correct my pronunciation, I of course would welcome that. So as you know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Appellant's counsel will have in addition, an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see the time clock on one of the screens on your view, and it will count down from 15 down to zero. Mr. Blondin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Carl Blondin, representing the appellant, John Kisielichin. Your Honors, I'm sure you're asking, why are we here? The child who is what the parties were litigating about is 18 years old, finishing up her second year in college. Quite frankly, this is a fight over money, and for my client, a significant amount of money.
Does she also, Mr. Blondin, does the daughter, does she also attend a secondary school? In other words, is she attending both high school and college?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And is, would you make a representation about when she would graduate from high school?
She's graduating this year, I believe in May. Yes, in May. And I think she's taking one class at the high school this year, and that's banned.
Let me ask you a question along the same lines, and maybe you can address it in your comments as well, the issue of mootness. So the panel will issue a decision in this case, of course, after it's submitted. And if there's no additional briefing requested, that would be within 90 days of today. And it seems as if you're suggesting that the young lady will have graduated high school by the time we likely would issue the opinion, or certainly within the deadline, outside the deadline. So my question for you is, do we know right now that she will certainly graduate by then? In other words, has she acquired enough credits to graduate now so that she will graduate before the time of the deadline of this opinion? And you can comment generally as to the legal question that's underlying my factual one with regard to mootness.
Your Honor, I believe she'll be graduating. I would be shocked if she didn't. She has more than enough credits, an outstanding GPA, type of student every parent would be proud to have. And yes, Your Honor, the question of mootness, that's why I brought this up. It's not going to be moot. The parties are still fighting about money. And unless these issues are addressed, the fight will continue.
Am I correct that the only money we're talking about, at least with regard to the contempt order, is the cost of the parenting time expediter? That looked like to me the only financial consideration, at least that jumped off the page at me.
There was an award of attorney's fees. My client has a significant claim for expenses that he believes should have been paid pursuant to the judgment decree that the respondent has not been paying. There's at least $7,000 in attorney's fees. My client, I think, has made a motion for something in the neighborhood at $25,000.
Well, I'm talking about the, I think the only issue on appeal is the contempt challenge. Am I correct about that? And if so,
that is correct. And I want to get back to that. And
well, let me pause you for a minute before you do. Are the monies that you're talking about now directly related to these attorney's fees for the contempt proceeding or something else?
Yes, there are attorney's fees related to the contempt proceeding.
Thank you.
But Mr. Blondin, I'm looking at your brief, and from pages 29 to pages 33, you have three brief headings, relating to directly to the both the procedure and the ultimate result of the contempt proceedings, but I don't see any issue on appeal about fees or expenses.
No, Your Honor. Quite frankly, if we address the issues on appeal, I think the issue of fees would go away. And I think the easiest issue to address on appeal is actually the third one I raised, and that has to do with the trial court declining to make a ruling on my client's Rule 52 motion for amended findings. The trial court denied the motion, and in its order, it refers back to, for the reasons stated on the record. If the court looks to the record, the July 9, 2020 transcript, pages 29 through 33, the trial court is basically stating that she did not have the authority and she couldn't do it because the previous trial court judge was elevated to the appellate bench. If we, in the respondent here did bring up the Kornberg versus Kornberg decision of the Minnesota State Supreme Court at 542 Northwest 2nd, 379. That was where the Supreme Court was addressing Rule 63 after a judge had retired. And the Supreme Court specifically stated that the new judge has the authority to consider a motion after a previous judge has retired. Well, here we have
my understanding of the rationale that the district court used, though, was not that there was any disagreement about authority. It was simply that there'd been an evidentiary hearing and the proceeding was thorough and the issues were thoroughly considered. So am I wrong about that? Is there a question about the court's authority to issue amended findings?
I think there is no question about the authority. My client has an absolute right, procedural right, under Rule 52 to make it a motion for amended findings. The court held a hearing, made findings. My client made a timely motion for amended findings. The prior judge was elevated to the Court of Appeals. The new trial court judge declined to do the work that Rule 52 envisions the court doing, and which the Supreme Court in Kornberg said that the trial court has the authority to do. My client had previously made a motion for amended findings after the first trial, and extensive amendments were made.
Mr. Condon, if I could just redirect you, I have a question, not to continually go back to the contempt, but that is why we're here. I am wondering what the status of the contempt is at this point. Did your client go to jail? Did your client do anything to purge the contempt? Are these issues that are truly and squarely still before us? I combed the record and just couldn't find answers to these questions. So maybe you can help me out there.
Your Honor, I too have problems with this case at times, trying to figure out where we are. My client was found in contempt. We made a motion for amended findings. Some amendments were made. There was then a second stage hearing, a Mahadi hearing, and the court issued a writ for confinement. That was not carried out. My client has appealed the matter, and the district court has not given him a date to report to the county jail because we are appealing. And quite frankly, purging is not possible at this time. We're talking about an 18-year-old adult. My client, if he's supposed to, first of all, we cannot force an 18-year-old to go on visitation. If she was still 17, my client couldn't go onto her campus, college campus, take her away.
I don't think that's, I think that's a little bit of a gloss on the facts and what the district court was doing. I don't think the district court was ever directing your client to force the young lady to comply with the parenting time parameters. But as I read the district court's decision, it was based upon your client's failure to do anything that would meaningfully or reasonably support the parenting time schedule. No disciplining of the child for failure. Not, and we're not talking about forcing, just basic parental, the least things that could possibly be done according to the district court's findings were not done. And your client seems to have either facilitated or at least allowed, even in the interim after the first hearing, the young lady to go and stay with your client's parents next door. That seems to be the biggest concern, not that your client somehow was failing some duty to force her to do something against her will. Did I misread the district court's analysis in some way?
I would not say you misread it, but what I would contend is the analysis is faulty. I think what's important to remember here is my client is being held in contempt for the acts of a third party, an older teenager.
That's not true. I just explained to you what I read in the district court's analysis wasn't your client was being held in contempt because of the young lady's actions, that your client was being held in contempt because of your client's refusal to do anything himself in order to encourage or inspire her to comply with the parenting time order, except sitting down and saying, well, you've got to do what's reasonable. Without directing her, you must go to your mother's. We're going to take away your cell phone, or we're going to do anything to discipline you if you don't do what I direct you to do, which is to comply. It seems to me that's what the district court was saying.
I understand your question. Thank you. I think that gets back to my original motion for amended findings. The district court makes a finding my client does not have rules. What my client testified is, I don't have rules, I have expectations, which I have to admit was a bit how I was brought up and how I brought up my own children. And we're talking about differences in parenting philosophy. At this point, we had a child who would actually moved out of my client's home. She wasn't in it all the time. One of the frustrating parts about this case is we have a young person who's now 18 years old, an adult, and no one once during her entire minority ever listened to what she wanted to do. The court would not listen to her. That becomes a very, Your Honor, that's very, very difficult in these family cases when we have cases where trial court judges will not listen to what an older teen wants. That always leads to heartache.
Mr. Blondin, let's say that we disagree with you. Now that the child has reached the age of majority, so there's that change in circumstances, what happens to the district court's contempt order? Does anything automatically happen because she's now 18, or is your client still looking at jail time?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. Obviously defending him, I would say, well, it's pointless because he cannot in any way compel the child to do something that she doesn't want to do. That's a bridge we need to cross. But I think first we need to get to the question of, we have erroneous findings. If the trial court does what it's supposed to do under Rule 52, and considers the motion and makes a ruling, perhaps those findings would be sufficient that the conclusions of law are that my client did not act improperly and shouldn't be confined.
My question was actually more specific to the mootness issue that was raised at the beginning of this argument. So irrespective of the findings issue, if we disagree with you, is the case mooted out because the child turned 18, or will that contempt order persist nonetheless?
I could not find no case law directly on that, Your Honor. As I said, this is something we are going to have to face in district court, and I'd rather face it after the district court has held considered my client's motion. My client's motion was not dismissed.
As to prejudice, can you identify the specific findings that you requested the district court to make that you believe would have changed the outcome in the district court's legal conclusion about contempt.
Ryan, let me see if I can find my motion.
Well, you only have a minute left. I don't want you to waste your time doing that.
I, not to toot my own horn, I think I made a very thorough motion setting out a number of findings that if the court adopted them, the court would not be issuing a writ of confinement.
Well, if you could, since you will have time for rebuttal, maybe, I don't want you not to pay attention to your opponent's argument, but maybe if you could divide your attention a little bit and just find, I'll be most interested in those findings that you believe would have altered the district court's decision about your client's conduct leading to the contempt, which was your client's conduct being failure to discipline, failure to encourage, those sorts of things. Not the young lady's position, how insistent she was not to go. I think the contempt order was about your client's behavior. So that's what I'd be looking to if you could.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Blondin. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal, as we've mentioned already. Ms. Ellsmore, on behalf of respondent, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As the panel has already mentioned, we're here on three topics, and I think the one that is most important is, does this case become moot when the eldest child emancipates? And as we know, under the law, a child emancipates upon turning 18 or graduating from high school, whichever occurs later. And so if this panel were to take the 90 days to issue a ruling, the child would emancipate prior to a decision from this.
Right, but we wouldn't know that. I mean, based on the record right now, is there information in the record that says right now she has met all of her graduation requirements? So even if she fails all of her current coursework, she would still necessarily graduate. Do we know that now as a matter of certainty in the record?
No, Your Honor. However, I believe that even if the court were to assume that the eldest child would be emancipated, these parties have two children. And the court's purge conditions are broad enough that I believe that they apply to both children. If you look at the purge conditions from the writ of confinement, what Mr. Kisilishin would need to do to purge his contempt is to simply write and sign a letter that says that he will comply with the parenting time that applies to both children, that he will communicate with my client through our family wizard, obviously.
But the contempt order was specific to one of the children, right?
The violation of the parenting time was based on the issue with one child, not both. Yeah.
Right. So he's not being held in contempt for failure to sign the purge conditions. He's being held in contempt for failure to meet the parenting time obligations for the one specific child. So the fact that there's another child that might be involved, I don't know that covers any issue that would implicate the question on the, would bear on the question of mootness. Do you?
I would agree that the contempt was brought based on one child, not on both. My concern would be that if this contempt were to be removed, that the parties would end up in a very similar position in a very short period of time. But I see Your Honor's point that the contempt action was brought based on the older child. When the initial writ of confinement was drafted and signed and filed, the eldest minor child was still absolutely a minor child. The delay in getting this action before you was due to factors outside of, I think, either party's control.
I seem to recall from my reading and preparation that there's no evidence in the record that the second child has the same preferences or inclinations as the first child, that the second child is just fine with the existing parenting time order. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, Your Honor, the younger child at this point is 16 and has been following, the parties have continued to follow the parenting time plan as laid out.
So I, okay, and would you, I guess, okay, thank you.
Do we have any, is there any indication in the record that if Mr. Kasilian, and forgive me, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that name, would have urged his daughter more, that there would have been any other result? I mean, it sounds like this is a pretty entrenched, without even getting her testimony, it seems apparent from the conduct that this is someone who really doesn't want to spend the parenting time with her mother. And she's at such an age where that may or may not have mattered if there had been a motion for modification of parenting time, which obviously we're not talking about that now, that didn't occur. Is there any indication in the record that any of the things that the district court suggested would have actually changed the child's behavior?
To some extent, that is conjecture at best. We're not sure. However, the point of this is I don't believe that Judge Bryan was ever intending to change the behavior of the minor child. I think that Judge Bryan's intention was always to change the behavior of the parent, in this case, Mr. Kithelishan.
Right, but the ultimate goal was to get the child to go and spend parenting time with mom. Absolutely. So, and it gets to, you know, I guess the issue that's being raised now on appeal, which is indirectly, is the contempt order really punishing dad for daughter's entrenchment?
And we can't assume what would happen. However, if the panel reviews the transcript as well as Judge Bryan's order, you will see that the questions put to Mr. Kithelishan were about his actions and his behaviors. If we had come back for a second hearing and Mr. Kithelishan had said, I took away her car, I grounded her, I told her she could not spend time with her boyfriend, I told her she couldn't go to prom, she still won't go. I started communicating with mom through our family wizard to express the things that I have tried and that it's not working, I think we would be in a very different position today, and I don't believe that the contempt would have continued.
Was the father, I'm curious, I guess, to be specific about the father's obligations. I guess, I mean, there's some discussion in the record that on some occasions the mother would come, it appears to me, correct me if I'm wrong, the mother would come to father's home to pick up the daughter. And they had, you know, there was one incident or more where they had a discussion or an argument at the father's house. And then the parenting time was not exercised because of disagreement. But I guess was that father's obligation really, I mean, basically to facilitate mother's picking her up at father's home, or was father required to deliver her in a sense, or to drop her off at mother's home? I mean, what specifically is father's obligation in, you know, what I'll refer to as a handoff?
In Judge Bryan's order, he indicated that.
Well, can I say before the contempt proceedings? What was the pre-existing obligation?
Yes. So resist, refuse cases are not uncommon at all in family law, unfortunately. And we're very well aware that the idea of picking up a child and tossing them in the back seat to drive to mom's house is not an efficient way to manage these resist, refuse cases. However, what we do know about resist, refuse is the party who has the power to help maintain or correct behavior or to correct relationships is what we call the in parent, the parent who the child has chosen or selected. Prior to any action for contempt, Mr. Kithelishan could have communicated with our client what he had tried in his home and what he was hearing. He could have communicated with the minor child what her obligations were and what his expectations were of her regarding following the court order that was laid out. There was no action on the part of Mr. Kiselishin that showed that he believed his obligation was anything other than to provide a home for the child and to let her make her own decisions on the matter.
And so what you referred to, it appears like you're referring to a body of law known as resist and refuse law. Is it, what's the authority for that? Is there a case law that's that you have in at the tip of your tongue that you could tell us about?
So resist, refuse is more an area of practice within family law as opposed to a body of law. Research has been done on the subject. I do not have citations for Your Honor at this time.
Can I direct you to the third issue, yes. If you could address that for a moment? It concerns me. I don't think it's, from what I've seen, it doesn't seem to be a proper basis to deny a motion requesting amended findings to simply say, the judge who decided the case is no longer on the court. And if there, I think the case law seems to suggest that if there's such a request made, there's the option of actually entertaining the motion or, in the alternative, conducting a new hearing if the matter is hanging on credibility determination, so that the new judge can make his or her own credibility findings on matters where that's really at the heart of things. So explain to me why it is you believe that a judge acts within the judge's discretion by denying a motion for amended findings under the circumstances of this case.
So in the Kornberg ruling, the court states that a successor judge can or may take up a motion for amended findings or reverse a prior decision if the previous decision is found to be clearly erroneous or unjust, or when there has been substantial changes to facts, the evidence, or applicable law. As was stated earlier, in the record, Judge Bartsch, our district court judge at that time, indicated that a full evidentiary hearing was held, that Judge Bryan made credibility decisions. And so it is not an obligation of a successor judge to take on a motion for amended findings. She has the authority to do so, but not the obligation. I believe that Judge Bartsch determined that the orders from Judge Bryan were not clearly erroneous or unjust.
So I'm looking at some language in the Kornberg decision, yeah. And the Kornberg seems to say that there are options. Either entertain the motion for a new trial or have a new hearing if it hangs on credibility determinations. And it seems like in this case, neither occurred. So how was it that the district court acted within within proper discretion?
So this matter and getting it to an order with our district court judge at that time was difficult because the district court judge believed that she could get the parties to resolution. And so we appeared on that matter three separate times. And it wasn't until the third time that we appeared on that motion that we actually sat in front of the judge on the record to make our arguments. At that point, Mr. Kiselishin's counsel, I believe, rested on the pleadings that they had submitted, rested on the affidavits and memorandums of law. And I do believe that the court issued a ruling following a hearing. I don't believe that what she did was deny I believe that she denied the motion. I don't believe that she denied to hear the motion.
I have a question about the ruling to exclude the testimony of the daughter. It seems like on the record, the district judge made a statement, essentially, I don't know that the credibility of the defendant is really at issue here. That was part of the reason for not taking the testimony. But then later, I'm looking now at the, I think after the second hearing, the judge made a finding on page 7 of the second order, addendum 23, saying respondent provided explanations for not making any effort to encourage the minor child to see petitioner, but none of these explanations is credible. So in the end, credibility, it seems, was significant there. I mean, in a case like this, with a lot of, you know, there's a lot of nuance to a case like this. And when you've, and when father's position had to do with, you know, who was responsible for making parenting time happen. I mean, wouldn't it have been really helpful to hear from daughter, maybe not about her preferences, but about her conduct in the past and about what she could say about father's conduct? Wouldn't that have been enlightening for the district judge in making a finding about contempt or not?
So, Your Honor, I would start with the differentiation between, yes, the court stated that with regard to the testimony of the minor child, it was not about credibility. Whereas in paragraph 29 on addendum 23, what the court is talking about is Mr. Kisilishin's credibility. What the court's point was as to why it was not necessary for the child to testify was because this wasn't based on the behavior of the child, but rather the behavior of dad. And if dad were to say, this is how I saw daughter behave, this is what daughter told me, what the court would have to find is not whether or not those were true, not whether or not the child was telling the truth or being, whether or not the child was credible, but whether or not a reasonable parent upon hearing that from a child would take the actions, or in this case, lack of actions, that Mr. Kisilishin.
But aren't the two very much intertwined, the conduct of the father and the conduct of the daughter? I mean, in other words, how can the district judge fully understand one without having evidence about the other, or from the point of view of the other person being the daughter?
Again, I believe that the reason to prevent or to keep the minor child from testifying was to prevent the argument that appellant is making today, that this was somehow about the child's actions or the child's decisions. And the contempt was never about the child's actions or the child's decisions. And determining whether or not Mr. Kisilishin was in contempt of an order that controlled his behavior and Ms. McNabb's behavior does not require the thoughts or beliefs of the minor child in this case.
Thank you. It appears there are no further questions. Unless you have anything further, unless you'd like to sum up, but I think we understand your position on each of the issues. So.
Yes, Your Honor. We would just ask that the appeal be denied and that the district court ruling be upheld.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Blondin, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. First, Judge Ross, I could not find my motion on my computer, but I think I set out in that motion. I couldn't find it because I'm panicking here in a few minutes, but I did file the motion. I think the motion is very thorough.
We do have it. It's certainly in the record. So don't be panicked over it. We certainly have it. And I was just curious if you had some of the findings that you could point to that would help me to believe, convince us that if the district court would have changed the findings, it would have actually changed the outcome of the contempt proceeding. I'm assuming you agree that there has to be some prejudice shown, even if we agree with you that the district court abused its discretion by failing to entertain the finding, failed to enter amended findings.
Absolutely. And I think my motion, the proposals I make were sufficient.
All right. Thank you.
I would like to draw the court's attention to the transcript from that July 9th, 2020 hearing, page 29, the bottom of the page, lines 23 through 25. The district court asked the question, do you have any authority that says I can go change, and then it gives the name of the prior judge's findings? Yes, it's Rule 52 in the Kornberg decision. The trial court judge did not deny my motion because she just refused to consider it. And my client deserves to have it considered. The judgment decree does require the respondent herein to provide all the transportation, referring to the earlier questions. This case is not moot because there's an award of over $7,300 in attorney's fees if the trial court considers my client's motion for amended findings, amends those findings in the way I suggested, then there'd be no basis for an award of attorney's fees.
But Mr. Blondin, I guess the question isn't about whether the case is moot, but whether the appeal is moot. In the appeal, you've raised three arguments for reversal, challenging all of them going to the district court's finding of contempt. So are those three issues still alive, justiciable, or will they be upon her graduation from high school, or will they be at that time moot?
I would say they are alive because if my client was found in contempt, a writ of confinement was issued. That has not been vacated. My client should have a right on the second issue I brought to call the witnesses he needs to protect himself from going to jail. We respectfully submit that the trial court did not follow Minnesota law on witnesses when it excluded this older teen from testifying and preventing my client from adequately defending himself. As I say in the first motion, we're appealing because essentially the district court, while it made certain findings, those findings are wrong.
Time is getting short. So let me expand my question a little bit. Are there any collateral consequences outside, other than this lawsuit, or excuse me, this legal proceeding? Are there any other collateral consequences external to this legal proceeding that would be, to which your client would be subject if there were a finding of contempt by a district judge that was not reviewed by the Court of Appeals?
Payment of $7,300 in attorney's fees, Your Honor.
That's in this case, right?
Right. Outside of this case.
Other than this legal proceeding, which is, you know, both perhaps it's a matter in Ramsey County and it's here at the Court of Appeals. Are there any other consequences that are adverse to your client?
Going to jail, paying the money, and my client, when he's faced that, should be able to call witnesses. As the court pointed out, there is a strong connection between the young woman's behavior and what happens.
What about a civil contempt, just a finding of civil contempt in the district court records? Is that a collateral consequence?
A writ of confinement was issued and my client faces jail because of the civil contempt. And if my client is facing the possibility of jail, he should be able to call an older teenage witness who is central to the issue of whether or not he's in contempt and whether or not he goes to jail.
And just one more question, if I could, Judge Johnson. Was there an offer of proof made as to what the young lady would have testified to, sufficient for us to determine that your client was prejudiced by prohibiting her testimony?
I have no independent recollection at this time, Your Honor.
Would you agree that if it's in the record, we should rely upon that to demonstrate what she would have testified to and make a decision as to any prejudice, and that if it's not in the record, then there's no showing made of prejudice?
I would disagree. There is prejudice because my client has a statutory right to call the witness. And our contention is his statutory rights were violated.
Right. You have a right to call witnesses, but if the district court judge, it's a presumptive right, correct? If the district court judge feels that there are reasons not to call a witness, like a child, for example, to become involved in a parent's dispute over parenting time for emotional reasons or whatever, or if the district court believes that testimony is going to be irrelevant, you would agree, wouldn't you, that then there must be some showing made of both prejudice and some information overcoming the judge's concern about the child?
Your Honor, getting back to the question of offer of proof. We do have the affidavit, which I would contend sets out a prima facie case as to what the child would say. Obviously, that'd be fleshed out with further testimony. And as the court pointed out, then suddenly at the end, there's a finding by the trial court that my client wasn't credible. Well, if the daughter had testified, perhaps it would turn on the daughter's testimony. Perhaps the court would have found the daughter credible. And we would have a completely different outcome here.
I thought the court said that it was taking as true what the father said about what the daughter would say or what the daughter has said. Am I misremembering that?
There was an affidavit that the daughter executed as part of her petition for emancipation, which was denied by the family court. Whoops, did I hit something?
I hit my mouse by accident. Keep going.
My client's contention is that the affidavit sets out a prima facie case, and it, more than that, is sets out reason to call the daughter as a witness, to flesh it out so all the facts would be there. My client was not afforded that opportunity. The court did not rule that her testimony would be irrelevant. The court just didn't want to call her because she was the daughter. I don't think that is, you know, I respectfully submit that that is not the law when it comes to contempt and the possibility of confinement, the significant curtailment of my client's civil liberties. When those liberties are at risk, I respectfully submit that my client has the right to call those witnesses, and my client was denied that opportunity to protect his liberty.
I have a follow-up question to your previous answer. That affidavit of the daughter, was that offered and received into evidence and considered by the district judge?
Yes, I do not believe it was an exhibit, but the district court judge referred to it and stated that he would be using it for his decision.
Thank you, Mr. Blondin. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, the appeal is submitted, and the court will issue its decision within 90 days. And that is our final oral argument for today. And so we will stand in recess.